I don't know who you are, but I don't care for it.
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't like what you're doing.
Yeah, definitely. That way, it's actually kind of depressing when you hate someone that you don't know for years and then you meet them and they're just fine.
Right.
Yeah, and you're like, no, that doesn't help with my psychological narrative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That is worst case scenario.
Yeah, yeah, that is. When you meet them and they're bad, you're like, oh, great. Perfect. Please be ruder. I need this. Yeah, yeah. It's tough stuff. But yeah, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about I'm Alan Partridge, season 2, episode 2. It's The Color of Alan.
The Color of Alan.
What an
Alan's funny stories
as Partridge. Yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe it's the golden age for Partridge now that Starmer's in charge.
What do you mean he's back?
He's just so close to the voice is very close,
right?
I do think Starmer's different. Starmer's more nasal. It gets out there. Look, I think it's important. And Alan, I don't know. Yeah, it's slightly different.
What region is Alan's accent?
Uh-huh.
Supposed to be.
It's southern. It's just like a type of guy. Like, yeah, it's kind of like generic English sounding. It's not really like I wouldn't call it a regional accent.
Right.
In that way where if you're from the south, you get to say that your accent's not regional.
Because
it's in
the
region that matters.
Is there a Norwich accent?
Yeah, there's a Norwich accent is kind of the same. Well, probably, I mean, a Norwich City accent is probably pretty unremarkable, but like a Norfolk country accent is a bit like that, you know, which is kind of the same as like a West Country accent, which is weird because they're on opposite sides of the country and there's none of that accent in the middle until you get to like West Oxfordshire. Oxfordshire is such a funny county because it's all the like really posh people, but then you've got like the proper Oxfordshire people who will like come out of the woodwork and you're like in a fancy pub in Oxford and you're just here like, fucking hell, mate, where do you think you're going? And you're like, oh, the surprise. Maybe that's the thing, just both of the two ancient universities had to be near a kind of a ready source of kind of like bumpkins. That was for whatever reason, that was an important like thing about bringing balance to the force.
Yeah, that accent has a real makes me think of children's television shows, that particular regional accent where it's just like, oh, it's like,
all right,
yeah,
I remember this is all fields,
yeah.
But
and it still is because it's rural Somerset.
And then some badges off on an adventure, you know, like that's exciting.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah,
I guess Oxford had to be near farms for them to be able to fuck all those pigs, you know.
Yeah, probably that is
I'm
probably
sorry.
This isn't that kind of show.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, everyone.
We have started, I assume. Is this kind
of... Oh,
yeah. Okay, great.
We like to ease ourselves in with a bit of ease. It really pissing off the regions, which is actually quite an Alan Partridge thing to do.
Very much so.
I wasn't referring to the women of the area. I mean, literal pigs that the farmers
have. No, I knew.
Have.
I knew you meant actual pigs. That's why I was so stunned.
You're up on
fucking
your...
Fucking actual pigs?
You're up on your British political news from 9 years ago. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, they've obviously Cameron fucked the pigs, but then also in like hazing rituals and stuff, aren't they always getting a pig and putting a pig in a pig or something? Like
putting a pig in a pig, a two pig roast, like one of those like multi birds, like just stuffing a suckling pig into a full size pig. I mean, it's kink. You
can
call it that.
With pigs.
Yeah, I don't know. I personally, actually, on the David Cameron fucked a pig, I am a truther. I don't think David Cameron is interesting enough to have fucked a pig. Because it was the only source for this is Lord Ashcroft's memoir, who is like a Tory peer who fucking hates David Cameron. So it's a little bit spurious. But it's the kind of thing where, like, I don't know, people love that shit about Oxford and Cambridge to be like, you know, there's a secret ceremony where you have to fuck a pig's head and whatever. And I'm like, I don't think there is actually that. I think there's people on both sides who are invested in you believing that there's a certain kind of like Oxford or Cambridge person who like likes the idea that they were in some secret ritual that you don't know about. And there's also a bunch of people who aren't Oxford or Cambridge people who love the idea that they're up to some perverse secret ritual shit. And so it's weirdly, it's like a horseshoe.
This sounds like someone who went to Cambridge who wasn't invited.
or it sounds like someone covering their tracks.
No.
They would never do such a thing.
I think Milo just didn't get the invite.
I went to the Cambridge equivalent thing a couple of times as a guest.
Yes.
Not to like the full on, because there's also like tiers of it, but I went to like the club where it happens, whatever. And
what the hell happens?
So there's
eyes
like
shut?
No, so there's like a club in there's a club in Cambridge and a club in Oxford. The Oxford one's called the Gridiron, and the one at Cambridge is called the Pit Club. And they're like gentlemen's clubs. So it's like an actual clubhouse where you can be a member and you have to be elected and whatever. Right. And then stuff like the Bullingdon Club is like guys from the Gridiron Club who are then in that more insane subset of that where they go out and do crazy shit. And there's also one at the Pit Club, the name of which seems to change year on year. But anyway, but so the, if you're kind of, if you, I've been to the actual, the place and met some of the, like been to events there, and it's like, there's like a bit of it, a bit of that sort of thing, but it's all like kind of quite tongue in cheek. Like they've got like a song and like a, I don't know, it's a bit like, especially now you look back on it and you're like,
fucking pig. Everybody sing along to fucking the pig song. Is that the song?
It may as well be. It may as well be. Yeah.
And then Harvard and, is it Princeton or whatever? What's Skull and Crossbones?
Skull and Bones is Yale, I think.
Yale.
Yeah.
And then, is that the one where
Harvard,
if you...
Harvard has something, yeah.
There's a group, and then if you don't make $1 million by the time you get to 30, they just give you, the group just gives you $1 million.
What's this group? It's
pretty, that's pretty sick. I want to join that club.
It's really nice.
Hey guys, I'm 31 and I've not made $1 million. I'm looking to join the club.
That's actually very positive.
I'm looking to take out fire insurance on my house, which burned down a year ago. Would that be possible?
Oh, God.
Yeah, pretty good stuff.
Do we know where Alan Partridge went to college?
I don't know if he went to university. I think the character is written as a guy who didn't go to university. Oh, that would be my
self-educated.
A guy of that generation. Alan Partridge now would go to university, but Alan Partridge then, I don't think so.
See, where does he fit in the class? Like, are we to think that he grew up rich?
Yeah, he's like a middle class guy, I guess. He's kind of like ordinary.
Yeah.
But he has like a fanciness about him, like he loves like the Lexus and the but that's such a like typical British dad coded thing to be like kind of, I don't know, like petit bourgeois or whatever, that kind of desire to.
And the stuff in the first season when we were pointing out like his references for he knows the idea of like wine would be fancy, but his references for wine would be a cheap wine.
Yes.
So he's in this weird in-between world between still wanting to impress like the builders.
Yes.
But also wanting to impress people as if he is fancy, but also isn't fancy because he can't quite play the game.
Right.
Well, he has that thing that so many people have in the UK, which is like a kind of class anxiety, where like he has enough money to be kind of comfortably middle class, but he doesn't have like the refinement that he perceives that you need.
It's
like
a Basil Fawlty vibe, right? Like that desperate need. Middle class anxiety, the desperate need to yearn for something more, and a hatred and disdain. Although I guess Alan kind of wants to be friends with the working class, or wants to meet them on like a masculine level, but also looks down on the peasants a little bit too.
And I think that ties in with his university vibe, which is that he would, because you had to, I think before about like, I don't know, 1985 at the very least, you had to be like quite fancy to go to university,
right?
Or at least from a family of people who went, like, I don't know, like your parents were like school teachers, so they both went or whatever. Like most people, even people with like some amount of money, didn't really go. It was like a kind of very, it was sort of really like the Blair era where like people start, whereas kind of in America, like I think earlier, like kind of everyone just went, or like if you had money you certainly went. Whereas in the UK it was such a like kind of class-based thing, class in the British sense of the word.
It's never been free, has it? There was a period in Australia in the 1970s when Gough Whitlam made higher education tuition free.
Oh, no, ours was always free until about 1999.
Oh,
really? Labour actually brought in the tuition fees.
Really?
Yeah, but they were like really small at first. They were like £1,000 a year or something, and then they gradually went up.
Jesus.
And now it's $9,000 or more, probably more now. It was $9,000 like years ago. Yeah.
$9,000 per year?
Per year, yeah. It's still cheap compared to a lot of places.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Anyway, we're on a bit of a tangent about the British higher education sector.
Yeah, let's talk about Spice World.
There's a man who's going to sort it out. The man for the job is going to sort it out the correct way at the correct time.
Would Keir Starmer find Alan Partridge funny? Would he get it? Could he recognize that that's fucking him there, basically?
Surely he'd get it.
Yeah.
He imagine must. If he didn't get it.
He's surely at the right.
That's amusing. This is just a perfectly normal English man.
Yeah, he's of the right age that he must have watched it, presumably.
How old is he?
He's 60, I think.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Which is like scarily young now. Like you're like, oh, a 60-year-old man, a man who was a grown up in the late 80s. Like that, you're just like, yeah. Fuck, that's yeah. Yeah.
I thought you meant younger compared to like Joe Biden or whatever.
Well, oh yeah, yeah. Also, oh, that. Yeah. They're from a completely different generation. Like, but yeah, Biden's like, what on earth is pulp, you know?
He's not 60 years old?
Yeah. He does look kind of, he's a lot older than Sunak. Sunak's like mid 40s.
Yeah, right.
Is he?
Yeah.
And what does Sunak sound like again?
He's not even finished growing yet. Guys, this is a momentous occasion. We're having an election.
I don't think I'll
the
ever get tired
of that.
The
future of our country depends on it. He does sound like a little man trapped in a well.
Yeah.
Please, will someone lower down the bucket so I can escape?
He's Rob Brydon's man in the box.
Yeah. Man in the box voice is great. We do open
he's
this.
He's 61 years old.
Good yeah, Lord. There
sorry,
you go.
Sorry to
he's just got to stay in power for 8 years and then we'll be set.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, we open with, I think, one of the all-time Partridge Radio segments where he's talking about the song Roxanne by the Police. And he's like, must give her a call sometime. Well, I'm sure the effects of 23 years on the game wouldn't render her pleasurable unto mine eye.
This was, yeah, the first 10 minutes of this episode was just like, the classic moments that I do remember when I did watch this show years ago was like, holy shit, you got this, funny stories, timing out to the news, Spice World, my kids don't want to see me. It's after hit.
Timing out to the news is so funny.
It's so good. I think Alex Dyson, who I did Triple J Breakfast Radio with it back in Australia, we used to talk about that all the time. Because, yes, time, if people don't know, well, I guess they can see very clearly, but you literally, yes, need to finish at exactly the right time to then kick in with the news or a promo or whatever. And
you got
to
hit the news button.
You find yourself with just nothing. Alex and I would look into each other's eyes. We're like, we have nothing to say. I wonder who got the battery pack.
Yeah. News. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah, the man who phones in and he's received the same drill back as a gift that he gave away, minus the power pack.
From Bungay.
Yeah.
Which I'm familiar with because I got a flyer 1 year in Edinburgh for a show called A Thatcher's Guide to Dogging in Bungay.
Oh.
And it's my favorite flyer I've ever received.
A Thatcher's Guide.
A Thatcher's Guide.
Because so, the view from the roof is quite good. You can absolutely see where people are dogging. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the
this is someone who thatches, not someone of the Thatcher family?
No, someone who thatches. He is a Thatcher.
Yeah, not Mark Thatcher. You wouldn't want his guide to anyone.
No.
Yeah, I mean, it is a confusing if you just hear it, but on the flyer, it is him thatching a roof. And on the back, you see
never
people
been
having...
dogging in Equatorial Guinea.
On the back is a photo of two people having sex on a car. And so we got obsessed with this year. And
that's quite graphic for the back of a
flyer.
It is,
but yeah, particularly graphic. But A Thatcher's Guide to Dogging in Bungay. And a couple of us went along to see this show because we've got to see what A Thatcher's Guide to Dogging in Bungay. A series of words I did not understand when I first read it.
Yeah.
Bungay, dogging, thatchers.
Yeah, it's that's quite what three words.
Yeah.
Dogging, Bungay, thatchers, yeah.
And we showed up and the man was there, the thatcher. Who was going to give us the guide to dogging
in
Bungay.
Did he have like a big hod of straw on his shoulder or did he have any props to really illustrate?
Well, we walk in to this venue and it's just me and these two friends of mine, gentlemen, all three gentlemen.
Two, three.
And he walks in and he goes, guys, no, it's just you three. There's a lot of nudity. I'm not going to do it to just guys.
There's a lot of nudity.
A lot of his own nudity?
Of his own nudity. And so he goes, and which made us even more curious. It's like, well, we'd love to see it now. What's this show? But it was the last day of the show, and we were the only audience members who showed up to it.
You're like
and so
frantically flyering the show on the street. We need some women to come in.
Women to come in. But the idea that he wouldn't do the show to just fellas really, really.
Yeah, because that would be gay.
That's the gay in Bungay.
Yeah.
That's why he wouldn't
show
do
about
it.
Dogging and they get all judgy and weird. And shy seems a bit strange.
Yeah, about being a voyeur.
Is dogging a purely British phenomenon? Like, I know we have people in Australia having sex in public.
Yes.
But we don't have a phrase.
I don't think we call it dogging.
Just fucking in the bush.
No.
Bush fucking.
Bush fucking. The bush fucker trial.
There's got to be a word for it, though, in the car situation where you go and you meet up and you have sex in a car or in a park.
Yeah, it's very much one of those things where, like, I think every nation has an equivalent, but only in Britain do we have such a codified sense of it. Like, yeah. Like, A, that there's a term, dogging,
yeah,
and B, that there's, like, it's, like, a known, like, there's, like, Facebook groups, you know, there's a... One of my mates at university got really, he was doing stand-up at the time, and he got really obsessed with, like, dogging and dogging groups and stuff, and he, like, he got really deep into the dogging forums. And he found this one post, which will stay with me until the day I die, which is, does anyone want to meet up for some sex fun, all one word, at the A40 lay-by toilets at, like, Junction, whatever it was. And then there was, like, line break, and then it was, I can be there at literally any time. And then the poster's name was Deep Dave.
Oh, no!
So credit to my friend Wilf for finding that post. An incredible, incredible. Yeah.
Literally any time.
Literally any time.
Schedule is wide open.
I work there.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. He was like, what is this man's job? And I was like, potentially lay-by toilet attendant.
Yeah. I am nearby. That's great. Yeah.
Cruising the lay-by toilets that it is your job to protect. Yeah.
And they like the thrill, or the being in public is part of the... attraction to the practice, or is it literally like it just allows you to have sex somewhere that isn't either people's houses?
Yeah,
I think part of it is the kind of swinging aspect.
I see.
And then part of it maybe the sort of voyeur element. Like, I think some people just go and watch, but then they do it in quite secluded places. I don't think it's somewhere where you'd be, like, particularly at risk of being seen by the public.
They're still British.
Yeah. It's a lot of, like, forest clearings and sure. stuff. Like, right, again, we're going back to badgers and yeah. But apparently also, because we did an episode about it for another podcast, and we watched the Channel 4 Dogging Tales documentary, which is about, it's about 15
Dogging
years old.
Tales.
And they're all wearing, like, animal masks to hide their identity in there. And so many of them are long distance lorry drivers. And they're like, and then this one lorry driver's going like, yeah, I mean, everyone on the lorries is into dogging just because, you know, it's boring. Like, just being a lorry driver is so boring that you're like, I guess I'll go have sex in a car park with the strangers.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. Just, I like the idea that, like, if you're bored enough, you'll try anything. Like, that there's, like, a level, everyone has a line. Like, there's a level of how bored you'll be before you're like, fuck it, I'll go dogging. And most people never find that line.
Yeah.
They never get bored enough.
Because there's an early lorry driver that would have kicked it off first, who would have done it and then told someone else. And then that second person would have been, like, driving along, would have hit his mind. He'd have been like,
yeah, the tacky pretty boring meter's going off. He's got to pull off.
Yeah. Pull over at any time. I'm available.
And which lay-by toilet should he happen to be near? Yeah, I don't know. It's like, maybe that's why the Germans are so kinky, because, like, they all have jobs that are so boring. It's like, I make the precision parts for the precision machine that makes the precision parts for other precision machines. And that's why they, like, they all get into piss, because they're just like, well, you have to, something has to balance that out.
Yeah.
Like, I have to wear a full gimp suit every weekend or I will never get through my job. Yeah.
It makes me feel alive.
I'm making the most boring part of the weapons for the Israeli military. The dullest, most inconsequential parts. The stabilizers. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, so.
That's scene one.
That is scene one. We've had a fun little. Was there anything in scene one? Were there any references, Pete?
Only the Bungay reference. Again, another episode, all clear for me.
All got clear.
I understood everything that happened. Sticks across the board for my understanding of English culture.
The rare all clear. as ever, I'm now trying to remember the order of operations in the episode. I think then we get a scene at the house where he's chatting to the builders.
Yeah.
He upsets the northern builder by doing a northern accent and then wanting to change the height of the skirting board again. I don't know, like... Changing the height of the skirting board is so funny to me because it's such a like perfectly inconsequential. I have like the complete opposite thing where if a builder asked me if I was okay with the height of the skirting board that they'd put in, even if I didn't like it, I'd have to be like, that's fine.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. How high is your skirting board supposed to be? Why would you care?
I don't know.
How many times has Ellen asked this guy to change?
4 or 5 inches?
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm like, do we even really need skirting board?
Whoa!
I know.
We've got a disruptor over here, guys.
Straight to the floor?
What if a lot of builders are just in the pocket of Big Skirt? Yeah.
Big skirt.
Big skirt. Yeah.
Think about it. A man putting a skirt on your wall is pretty gay. Huh?
Yeah, pretty gay. Unless it's covering up something gayer, you know.
But what could that be?
The arse of the wall? I don't know.
Is that what a mouse hole is?
Yeah. Like,
that's why it's so low.
I believe that my house is male and it's trying to fuck me. And so what I have to build all these Victorian things to cover it up so that I'm not tempted. Yeah. Just being on the run from your own sexuality at all times. That's the key. Yeah. And then Sonia has had printed all of these mugs and cushions with Alan's face on them. And she wants to sell them. Which is baffling because I don't know who she thinks the market is for that. But that's what's great about Sonia. You never, none of it ever quite makes sense. Like, it's sort of the idea that she would have had them printed for around the house, I can see you would find disturbing, but it would kind of make sense. But having them printed for sale, it's just pushing it that bit further.
What was on one side? His face on one side and a cat on the other, yeah. Is it? For yeah. No reason. Just because she likes cats, I assume.
Yeah, just a combo of just two things I like to get. It's like people who put ketchup on pasta, and you're like, what are you doing? And they're like, well, I like ketchup and I like pasta. And you're like, that's not a good enough reason. Yeah. Alarming. Why is my memory is shot as shit today? It's a good job that we get to edit this. The listener doesn't have to hear about me.
We get to edit it
together after
yeah,
the recording.
All three of us. Yeah, that's right. That's
we go
the
through and we
bit.
Pick our favorite parts and at least favorite parts.
Yeah, right. So yeah, the main point, the main thrust of the episode is that he's doing this presentation for a fireplace company called Dante Fires.
Yes. Mm.
Great name for a fireplace company. I really feel like more fireplace companies should have names that reference the hell and the infernal. That would be great. There's this South African man coming from Dante Fires who Alan has to meet. And then it coincidentally turns out that Alan is at Norwich train station attempting to sell copies of his book Bouncing Back with like a head mic on,
yes,
aerobics instructor style, when he notices the man emerging from the train and he's like, I'm gonna have to, he can't see me, I have to style this out. So he walks up and pretends that he'd just come to the station to meet him
while wearing a headset mic.
Yeah, perfect. That's I like to be audible at all times. That's what it needs. And so then he takes him back to his unconstructed house Apache. I feel like later we get a scene in a different episode where he discusses his rationale for like different names for the house, which I thought we get before this, because obviously Apache is one of them.
Yeah.
And he's like speculating on what he's going to call the house. And so then I've remembered it in a more logical order than it is actually in the show. I was like, oh, that feels like we should have got that first. And then the fact that the house is called Apache will be like a fun callback, but right, it seems we get it later.
He explains the reason for Apache later in the series.
Sort of. There's like a scene where he goes through things he's considering naming the house, and one of them is Apache, but then somehow he's already started calling the house Apache before this. Yeah. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I remembered that scene coming before this, but it seems
right, it's a call
it doesn't.
Forward.
Yeah, it is a call forward, yeah. Time is a flat circle. The thing about Alan Partridge Season 2 is it's a lot like the film Tenet. Lynn is actually moving backwards through time.
Whoa, she's the protagonist.
Yeah.
The South African guy, is it Steve Brody, according to my notes here? Is he in The Office or Extras or something?
He's in This Is England, which is where I recognized him from. He's in the series for This Is England as like a minor character in that.
England,
but I'm like, who is that guy? Because I'm like, his brain, his head was stuck in my head. But I don't know. I think he is. Must
I feel
be
he,
as well.
Like he's David Brent's manager or something. Or he played that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
My knowledge of the UK Office actually not very good.
It really?
I've seen like bits of it, but it was not, it didn't really penetrate our household particularly.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I was curious about what's the relationship between Steve Coogan and Ricky Gervais, because Brent is a very he's a very Partridge-ish character in a post-Partridge world.
Yeah, that is interesting. Well, I guess Partridge came first, I guess.
So. Yeah,
of course.
Because The Office is like 2000?
Yeah,
something like that, yeah.
But I remember The Office blowing my mind, being like, this is completely original comedy, and then you start to learn a bit more. It's like, oh no, there's quite a few people before I knew it. So it's kind of similar thing.
Yeah, actually, yeah. It was like, oh, and this one, and this one.
Christopher Guest and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And forgive me if you've already covered this on the show, but how the fuck is this show shot? because it is, it has a studio audience, but it's shot so close. Like, it's not shot like a multicam sitcom on a set.
I think it's, they film it, shoot it, edit it, play it in front of a
play
studio
to the audience and take that. See, I thought that too, but there are moments when they're pausing.
Yeah.
Where the actors are waiting for the audience's laugh.
I think sometimes it's on a set in front of the audience, and sometimes when they when that's not possible, they then show it.
Just outside.
So, I think we looked this up in a previous episode. Yeah, they were like, it's like hybrid. So there's like some of it is shot on a set in front of an actual audience, and then some of it is shot like on location, and then they play it to an audience.
Yeah, man, it's I don't think I've ever seen a show like that. I think when it's shot in front of a live studio audience, like Friends or whatever, you tell it's like a theatrical, almost a theatrical set.
Yeah,
but this one is it's shot really close, and yet
they could just be pausing for it, knowing that this is a punchline.
Yeah, just the raw confidence.
Because, but like, I mean, this especially season two, the audience is red hot. They are crazy for it.
They are loving it in season two.
They're losing their mind at every line. Yeah. Which makes me think, it was like, well, you would pause after. I mean, if you like, you knew writing it, it'd be like, that's funny. Loss,
I guess.
And
so.
Pause.
God. Yeah.
Put a beat in.
Yeah.
That's how I practice my stand up at home. I always, always
one, two, three.
3 minutes of bits, leave a 7 minute pause for laugh, and that's my time. Thank you.
Is a standing ovation.
You got to factor in how long it takes them to stand up. Could depend on the age of the audience.
Big laughs when Michael, when like Alan does the mime fucking, and then Michael also does his version of fucking a woman. Like, yeah. That is a woman, right? Like, yeah, long hair. Could be Brian May.
Yeah, that's not his cup of tea. That's the other one. God rest his soul.
Alan's funny stories.
That to me is, I think, one of the most Partridge things is the like cascading, like riffing with yourself.
Yes. Going, like, yes.
Could be Brian May. That's not his cup of tea. That's the other one. God rest his soul. Like just like one thought triggering another. Yeah.
Which is what you would do on radio. Like, yes, on radio. When you, if you're just presenting radio by yourself, you just have to constantly pursue any stream of consciousness to fill time.
Yeah, you gotta speculate on the sexuality of the members of Queen.
Some
of which are more obvious than others. ranking the members of Queen in order of whose sexuality I'm most sure about, starting with Freddie Mercury in first position, and then working my way back from there.
The bit with the door in, I think, in the house is like pretty all time, like great physical.
Oh yeah, the
bit.
Door used as a table,
trying to balance everything, and then Lynn bringing in the coffee.
Yeah, so he tries to take the South African guy to Chorister's Country Club. That comes up a lot in this season.
Yes.
They won't let... he discovers because he's booked the room in the name of the real IRA as a joke to make a point about their security. There are police in there, and then he has to leave. And so he takes him back to his house, but he sort of gives Michael a heads up. So Michael the Geordie has constructed a series of like Heath Robinson furniture items to make this guy think that Alan doesn't live on a building site. But this is an element of it I find bizarre because it's obviously a building site. Like, there's no, even the peremptory things they've done to try and make it look like a house is not even remotely scratching the surface. But also, it's not embarrassing for your house to be in the process of being built. Like, you can just be like, oh, I'm building a house.
Yes.
So I live in a static caravan. It's not like I live in a caravan. It's like I live in a caravan next to my house, which is, you can see, is being built. So this is one of those things where I find the character of Alan fascinating, because I'm like, what does he think is embarrassing about the fact that he's building a house?
Because the South African guy also doesn't care.
Yeah.
He can see through all of it. He can see the sign. He knows it's a toilet door. He knows what's going on. And he doesn't care. He still wants to have the meeting. And this is also true of a lot of the time, where it's just like, Alan is overcompensating for something the other person doesn't care about.
I do love the taking all the torches, really the free torches that he's giving out with his book too.
Yeah.
Constructing them into a candelabra of torchlight.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, genius in a way.
Genius.
Tied to a bicycle wheel. We get this. Also reminded me of my mum said that when she was a kid, if they had people over, her dad would quite often take the door off and use it to extend the table.
Like, really?
He would just take the door off of its hinges and then like put it on like trestles or whatever, and then it would act as a, because they only had like a small table because they had a small house. And this was just like a thing Cockney people were doing in the 60s. Just like, take the door off, will you, Len? We got a family coming round.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Golly.
And so I don't know if there's some deep cut reference. I don't know whether Steve Coogan's family have a similar deep lore. But yeah, it did make me think of that.
Well, it's also, he lifts up the fruit bowl and it's obscuring a toilet, like a male symbol. So it's like a toilet door. It's like, where's that going in the house? I guess that is an Alan Partridge thing, to have like a male.
Having a gender.
There are only
toilet.
Two genders.
In your own house is very funny. I think, well, you know, Adrian Childs has a urinal. Has Adrian Childs like made it onto the Australian internet? Like the
crazy Guardian columnist?
Yeah.
There's a urinal in his house.
Yeah. The thing about Adrian Childs is like it fascinating mind. Mm. Like he's always been fascinating. Like he's always had like jobs on TV that are bizarre. Like he was hosting the football coverage during, I think, the 2014 World Cup. And like the man is like, he's not a football pundit. He's a TV presenter who, like, I guess likes football in his private life. But just like he was putting off the other football pundits like so much just with like the batshit stuff that he was saying. But he's very like harmless. He's like, you know, he's like a nice man who just like is a bit Partridge. And he has a urinal in his house and it was the subject of one of his Guardian columns. And he's like, I love my urinal. It's great. It makes my life so much easier. And I do kind of, you know. Yeah, because pissing standing up into a toilet is a much more high-risk procedure than pissing into a urinal. Because, you know, sometimes when, as a man, your piss will just go in an unexpected direction.
What?
Just, you're like, 9 times out of 10, the piss is coming out straight. You're like, great. 1 time out of 10, it's like, I'm going to come out at a 45-degree angle. You're like, why are you doing that? What? How does that help anyone? I'm being let down by my own penis. And, you know, with a urinal, it's so close. To the action.
It is funny to install a urinal.
Blank range.
Is it a single urinal or is it a whole
trough? He's got a trough.
Like the trough is brutal. Your son or something when you're there.
Yeah, that's quite nice. The whole family, 3 generations pissing at one urinal. Yeah, that is great. The ceremonial urinal.
Oh my god! Again, that would be a Partridge thing to do. Yeah.
I hate a trough. I abhor a trough.
Oh yeah.
I think they're very inefficient as well. Because I think actually people leave more space between themselves at a trough than they do at like urinals.
Yeah.
Because you're in charge of how much space you're leaving. It's not like a predetermined. So I think you're like extra cautious. I think that's the weirdest thing about the urinal. I don't care if anyone wants to look at my dick, but I'm so concerned that anyone might think I'm looking at someone else's dick. That's the weird. Like you're like, I have to piss so far away from this other man to make it clear that I'm not doing anything weird.
This is why you didn't get invited into the clubs at Cambridge.
Yeah, maybe. You're pissing close.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one test they do. They just watch you go to the toilet one time. They're like, got him.
You got to have 2 urinals facing each other. That's the ultimate test. Can you do it? Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So yeah, we get this funny scene where like the door is balanced on this kind of like carpenter's trestle, but it's only balanced on one. So we get kind of like Alan and Lynn doing like comedy entrapment style bits where they're like placing stuff on opposite ends of the table at exactly the same time. Alan like rolling a tangerine down the table in an attempt to balance. And the guy going, do you want me to put it down in the middle, Alan? He's like, yes.
I've just thought about this Guardian writer.
Yeah.
What if he doesn't have a urinal and he just has a sink? And the entire time he's like, I've got a urinal. I use that instead of the...
Well, just kind of like a fruity-shaped urinal, but it's actually just a sink.
It's just the
sink. Oh, what an interesting urinal.
Yeah, just piss in the sink. You don't need to... You're so worried.
I mean, I guess if you have a sink that you just use for that, it functions as a urinal.
Works the same. Piss in the shower. There's heaps of places that you can maybe piss in your own house.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad that society has come around to pissing in the shower now that people are like, well, it's environmentally friendly.
And,
isn't it bad for foot stuff?
No, apparently it's good for foot stuff.
Oh,
the foot guys love it.
Adrian Childs installed a urinal in his flat and says women wretch when they see it.
Wretch? What's he doing with this urinal?
Broadcaster and columnist Andrew Childs absolutely baffled readers by revealing he has a urinal in his flat. Childs made the revelation in an opinion piece in The Guardian, in which the title claims that it's changed his life.
Yeah, now women wretch when they're at my house.
It sits below a stained glass window that features the football of West Bromwich Albion. I guess the crest is above it.
Yeah.
He also admitted that women haven't been so keen. Charles wrote, I'm a great enthusiast for urinals in the home. This is enthusiasm shared by very few people, especially women, who have been known to wretch at the very sight.
Well, I mean, women have no skin in the game with a urinal.
Yeah. Where is it? How close to his toilet is it?
That's yes. Is because if the urinal's in the same room as a traditional toilet,
traditional, how we recognize it,
the OG. Mm. That's kind of bizarre. It's a separate room.
Separate room, which in which case you don't need to
is,
be showing
is
any
same
women.
Room that bizarre? I mean, presumably you're not going to use both at the same time, but.
But there's no real extra benefit to having it. You could have your urinal in a separate space to your toilet, which means that you could use the urinal and someone else could use the toilet.
That's true.
But if they're in
I
the
think
same
the benefit
space,
is surely convenience of the piss itself.
It says that he says it avoids men being chastised for leaving the toilet seat up or having a poor aim.
Well, there you go. It's about the quality of the piss. It's not a time saving procedure. The throughput of people needing the toilet at his house isn't high enough.
Yeah.
For that to be a concern. It's interesting though, isn't it, that it's so frowned upon to have a urinal in your house. Like it is kind of logical. Yeah, you know, Adrian Charles is making a logical case for having a urinal, but it makes people uncomfortable. People don't want to see that. They're like, that's something you have at the pub, at the leisure centre, at a primary school.
What is not logical is having a Guardian opinion column and choosing this as the subject.
Yeah.
Well, so we interviewed him about his Guardian opinion column.
Oh, yes.
And he said, he just went like, well, you fucking try and write a column every week about something. You know, he's like, honestly, he's like, if you write one better than my, send it to me, write one every week, send it to me and I'll send it to them and we'll see if they publish it. Which I did respect as an answer. He was just like, he was like, of course I'm bad at writing an opinion column. It's impossible to have that much of an opinion about something every week.
Other headlines include, I have one question for delivery drivers. Do you need to use my toilet? An ear and nostril waxing is exquisitely painful, but just what I needed. Large or extra large? My perilous first condom purchase. Yeah, he rules.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great stuff. And you're probably getting some of the way towards his need for a urinal. You know, he's clearly packing some meat there.
Well, the subheading of the condom headline is, in the autumn of 1986, on a busy London road, my embarrassed student self learned that size really does matter.
Beautiful. You know, it's probably like trying to get control of a fire hose.
The child's hog.
I mean, that is the best answer to. I didn't think that was a very good column. It's like, you try doing it.
Yeah, huge respect. I do think that's what footballers should say in post-match interviews.
Yeah.
They're like, how did you miss that? You give it a go.
Yeah.
You do it.
That is always my thought whenever anyone's like shitting on your comedy or like, oh, that movie sucks. I'm like, well, you make one, but that's not really how it's supposed to work. It's not their job, is it?
Yeah. Well, usually what I say when they're like, that's not funny, is I'm like, yeah, but statistically you're wrong because I've done it in front of thousands of people like over the years and they mostly think it's funny and you're one guy. So, you know, given that funny is a social construct, you are just wrong. Like, you know, it's not funny to you, fine, but you can't say it's not funny in general because I've done the research and it is. And they genuinely do not know what to say to that. Like they have no comeback to that. I've done that on stage before to a heckler who was like, be funnier. And I was like, no. I was like, this is the correct amount of funny that I've determined that I need to be over years of doing this professionally.
Yeah. Be funnier is such a funny heckle. It's like, this is all right. Yeah.
It won't surprise you to learn in Australia.
Yeah. Of course.
And I think I said, you are a blip.
You are a statistical anomaly.
Yeah, I'm not interested at all in your opinion.
You are a black swan.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, you're someone from Perth.
Yeah.
Can't let him in.
Be funnier.
Be funnier. Fun. Yeah, what a heckle.
Great heckle.
Yeah.
Brutal.
Yeah, it is pretty brutal stuff. But yeah, so yeah, he has this meeting with a South African guy. We get some funny comedy bits. Alan is asking if he can do jokes at the presentation, and the guy says, no, you can't. And then he goes, well, there's no need for that. And then he asks him if he could please direct his anger down the center of the table for the purposes of balance. And then we get the scene where
what's
he goes,
the line about would they be allowed on the bus in apartheid South Africa?
Oh, yeah, because he does this whole riff about how he loves South Africans and he bought their tomatoes even when he wasn't. Oh, that's it, clown.
That's right, he supported them when he was cutting a thing.
We don't want a clown, Alan.
A clown,
and he's like, look, if you want a clown, with all those long shoes on, they'd never fit. And then he's like, How do they go down in South Africa? It's not another one thing or the other, are they? And all that makeup, you know, were they allowed on the bus? And the guy just staring at him blankly. Yeah. Yeah. It is. I think it's tough being a white South African internationally because, you know, you've got a lot of stuff to come back from. Yeah. There's a, you know, like, and a lot of them are not doing a lot to dispel those notions. We were in Bali and we heard some people like in front of us. We were like doing a tour of this like coffee plantation, the kind of stupid shit you do in Bali that you would never do normally. You would be like, let's go on a tour of a coffee plantation. And then you get talked into it. There you are. You're learning about the coffee that the lemurs shit out or whatever it is. Oh. And yeah, we're following these two like kind of middle-aged women around. And then my girlfriend's going to me, where are they from? Like, I can't tell where they're from. And I'm like, well, it sounds like they're speaking Dutch, but also there's this inescapably fucked vibe that doesn't sound quite right. And then like one of the guys said something to them in English. And they went, ah, is it? And I was like, ah, I was so good. I should have known. And then we ended up sat opposite them. And we were basically just silently in our heads doing the countdown of like, when will they say a fucked thing? One of them at some point, she was complaining about how she had a headache. And she's like, oh, so I won't have any of the coffee because I've got a headache. And I'm like, oh, no, coffee's actually good for a headache. It dilates your blood vessels. And she's like, oh, is it? And I'm like, yeah, yeah. And then Annabelle goes like, oh, I've got a paracetamol. She wants to know. She's like, no, no, I don't believe in medicine. And I'm like, uh-huh. And then we got something about...
In medicine?
Yeah. I can't remember, was it like modern medicine or something like that? Mm-hmm. She was a natural remedies gal.
Yeah, right.
She had a like a leatheriness about her of a natural remedies person. I don't know if that's necessarily a correlation, but I don't know. Yeah, it felt right. And yeah, and then at a certain point, she was talking about how she went to stay with her daughter in Johannesburg, and she's like, "But it's rough there, you know. It's too many of them, you know. You know what I mean?" And we were like, "Oh, there we go. There it is."
Too many of doctors.
Yeah.
Too much medicine.
Too many of those bloody Johannesburg people. Yeah. And she lives in, of course, Perth.
I mean, of course. Maybe.
Of course. Beautiful. But yeah, so yes, Alan is he's pouring out his white South African stereotypes. Tomatoes from the 80s, so on and so forth. And then we get, I believe we cut straight to him doing the Dante Fires.
He tries to break in.
Yeah, yeah, right. So he goes to the country club. They've now... The security guard now has a vendetta against him because all episode he's been doing these fake like terrorist threats at the intercom to prove how they'll still let him in anyway. I'm an arsonist with a big box of matches, etc. And then the guy doesn't let him in, and then so he decides he's going to climb over the fence. And Lynn at the crucial moment distracts him, and then he goes, "Lynn, I've pierced my foot on a spine." And then it looks like they're not going to show the injury. And then you get this brutal, like, half-second cut to his just, like, bloodied foot on this spike. I don't... You would have to put so much force to get one of those blunt railing spikes through the shoe and the foot.
It's just the dumbest injury. So easily avoidable. And yes, hard to do. He really... his feet get a good... shot the foot in Alpha Papa too, doesn't he?
Maybe.
Where the gun goes off and gets shot directly in the foot.
I saw the movie, but my memories of the... Yeah, something about the tasers in a pizza box. I mean, the foot pierced on a spike is so one of those injuries that you get warned about at school.
Right.
And then it never comes up in your adult life. They're like, don't climb over fences, kids, because you know what happened to this one boy? Foot pierced on spike. That we see it all the time. We see it all the time. Like, do we? Do we see it all the time? I think the only time
it's actually very difficult to do. Get through the shoe.
Yeah. It's got to be so sharp.
It's got to be the sharpest.
Yeah. It's got to be like a fucking like a Japanese cleaver, like level of just. Razor, like these like katana spikes that they've got out the front of there.
His line reading on spike though is the funny, possibly the funniest spike. Word he says in the entire
It made me laugh as much as when he's having sex in the people need access to Dixons.
Yeah, they do need access to Dixons. That's very true. And then Lynn is like, well, just pull your foot off this mic. And he's like, you pull your foot off. Yeah. And then someone's coming in for the presentation. He goes, oh, hello, Dante Fires. Oh, you're going to have a good time.
Oh, it's very amusing.
And there's such a darkness at its core, because we then get him kind of like in the foyer of the fireplace bit, and then Lynn's like, you can't, you've got to cancel. And he's like, Lynn, some of these people have come from Stoke. He's like, look at the blood squelching in my shoe, you can hear. She's like, I could go on for you. And he's like, you couldn't present a cat.
Yeah, that was an incredible line.
Yeah. His contempt for Lynn is such a like great through line of the show.
And is the plot in the first series that Lynn's in love with him? Is Lynn in love with Alan generally?
Yeah, a little bit in the first series, yeah.
Yeah, and I think sort of a bit in the second series also, but it's strange. There's also that Lynn does get a love interest later in the second series, which Alan does not care for at all. Right. He's very unhappy about Lynn's love interest. And yeah, so in the end, Alan goes on, and we get this kind of really bleak scene of him just at a lectern, just stopping just to throw up behind the lectern periodically while trying to talk about fireplaces. And he's doing these gags that he's written, but just like through wretches. Like, you know, do hit your targets or you will be fired.
It is another example of him putting himself through so much pain and effort for something, for the lowest of stakes.
Yes.
They don't need him to do this. They don't care if he cancels, but he's insisting on covering up the fact that he's injured himself for no reason.
Yeah.
He just makes his entire life.
Get a second season. This is all he's got.
Yeah. It's also like you have to be in so much pain to be throwing
yeah,
up.
Yeah, yeah.
Like just from, like that is so, yeah, I don't know. There's something just so visceral about this scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, really grim. But you see the darkness at the core of Alan, you know. He feels the need to. And I think in the entertainment industry, we all have that in us somewhere, you know.
The people's reaction, exactly the same as if it had been going well. Like, it's not like if it goes perfectly that they're enjoying it any more than they are as he throws up through it.
Yeah, it's a corporate. It's never fun.
Yeah.
You may as well be.
Their complete indifference to him vomiting everywhere is just.
When he sets off the fucking pyrotechnics, it's like $2,000 that costs.
Yeah, I got a little bit confused. When he's talking to the South African guy, he's like, can we get fireworks? Like, he wants to book a variety of visual spectacular to sell it. Okay, right. And then he spent $2,000 on them. Oh, yeah,
I don't know if pyrotechnics are like particularly expensive. I've never had to book any.
Right.
No. But yeah, possibly. Mm. Yeah, they can pay. There was Joel Dommett in 2014 had a really fun show at the Fringe called Finding Emo. And the premise of the show was about trying to get together the emo band that he was in when he was at senior school. And he had this set piece in the show, which I figured out because I went and saw the show more than once. But basically the premise was he has like a confetti cannon on stage and he gives someone in the audience the remote. And he's like, you'll know when it's the right time. Like, I'm not going to tell you, but like, you'll know when it's the right time to set it off. And it's like, okay. And then there's this bit in the show where he's like, yeah. And then one of the guys in the band, like, I went around to his house and we'd not spoken since we were teenagers. And then I learned that he had stage 4 prostate cancer. And then the confetti cannon would go off at that point, but it would just be like a person backstage triggering it. And he'd be like, dude, that was not... That was not the time. Like, why would you set it off? That's obviously why. Like, I said, you would know, but like, that's too, how could you possibly think that was around the person? Like, I didn't touch it. I don't know. Then I was like, yeah, was that real or was that? And then I went and saw it a second time, and I was like, oh, this is real psychological shit. He's really fucking with the audience.
Does he still do stand up?
I think so. Yeah, he's kind of, but he's now done that classic British comedian thing where you get famous enough. You don't really have to do stand-up anymore. You're just on TV all the time. And people are like, it's Joel Dommett. Look at him try this cake.
Remember when he saw his dick?
Wait, what?
You don't remember the Joel Dommett sex tape?
I do. What? For some reason. I remember people talking about it.
I think he's got a good sense of humor about this, so I don't think it's too fucked. But right, yeah, it was one of those classic.
I've seen him talking about it too.
Yes, yes. Like a cam of him touching himself. He thought he was pleasuring himself for the benefit of another lady. And the video was recorded and then leaked.
Oh, yeah, that is brilliant.
And he went off at the wrong time.
Don't come right when she says I'm your stepmother. That's weird.
Why'd you blow then?
Why? Why? I do remember that Joel Dommett was fired from MTV for explaining to Harry Styles what pogs were. And he was like, you don't remember pogs? And like, and then they were like, you're too old to present this program.
Brutal.
Yeah, yeah. It's very like, I think presenting a program that's so like youth like that, it has like a very like Logan's Run vibe. Like suddenly you just start talking about Hanson and no one knows what you're talking about. And like the gem in your hand is glowing. And you're like, fuck, I've got to go to Radio 2. No. Yeah. Bad times. But yeah, and so then we get this kind of like scene after this where Alan has been to the hospital, he's had a lot of morphine, and Michael the Geordie, to cheer him up, has drawn him a helipad in the back garden, but it's got a lowercase h, which is such a funny thing to get wrong, especially because like Michael's supposed to be like a military guy. Yeah. And he's like, why is it a lowercase h? And he's like, well, because it's not, you know, it's not a big helipad. And he's like, yeah, but then... Yeah, I'm just doing it to cheer you up, like, you know.
Where do they come up with this stuff? I don't have much to comment on. This is a wonderful program. And I enjoy it very much. 10 out of 10 for me.
Yeah. And then, yeah, he's just babbling because he's on morphine. Perfect. Have you ever had a fun anesthetic experience?
No. I'm not sure if I've ever been on it.
You ever had the endone? No. I went to a music festival once and just injured my back. And took a lot of drugs, and that was a bad combination. And then, so for the drive,
injured your back at a music festival.
Well, I already had a dodgy back, and then the music festival is just sort of standing on a hill for a long period of time. And,
oh, yeah, standing on a hill is not good for your back. Hey, no, no.
Yes, so I had to take a lot of endone for the car trip home, and it was lovely.
Yeah, were you having sort of pleasant babbling hallucinations?
You just feel really cozy.
Oh,
everything's gonna be all right.
I'll tell you what, opiates, they are good, hey. You know, people, they get a bad rap because people are like, they're so addictive, they destroy lives. And it's like, yeah, but why are they so addictive? Yeah. Why do they destroy lives? Because they're so good.
So good.
Yeah. They only destroy lives because people take them away. You know? If you keep giving people for free opiates in a measured dose, they'll be happy forever. That's my, you know, you put the price up, you start giving them the wrong dose, you get problems. Sure. But the same regular dose... in an affordable way every week. Oh, people are going to be happy as Larry.
What could go wrong? So you haven't seen Mid Morning Matters or This Time with Alan Partridge?
I have seen Mid Morning Matters.
Okay, right.
But I haven't seen This Time.
Right.
Apart from that clip of Steve Coogan interviewing himself as a sort of like Irish man from Country Sligo. Ugh. Yeah,
so good.
This is a clip Tom sent me yesterday, yeah. And then he's like singing, "Come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man."
Have you
under protest?
No,
with Alan Partridge? Oh, it's great.
This is my first experience with Alan Partridge.
Oh, sorry, that's right. Okay, you haven't seen any of it, right? No. You haven't seen the movie. Oh my lord!
Yeah, the movie's fun.
I love the movie.
Yeah, I liked the movie. Yeah, I don't know. I just kind of there's some of the Partridge TV stuff that's come out in recent years. I'm not as keen on. I don't know. I find that some of the magic has been lost. I think it's because what I love about I'm Alan Partridge, the TV series, is that it's about him being a washed up loser. And so then him, like the This Time thing, because it's inherently predicated on he has his own TV show on the BBC again.
Mm.
It sort of loses some of the luster of like the.
He's still very much a loser.
Yeah,
and he's clearly trying. It's funny because it's a very similar premise or world to Get Kraken, right?
Yeah, right.
Which was a comedy in Australia with the two Kates who would go on to make Deadlock and, yeah, very funny ladies.
Deadlock, here it's shit.
I'm a fan.
They've got this one guy in it. Really ruins the whole thing.
Might be in season two. But anyway. Yeah. But yeah, they're like two desperate early morning breakfast show TV hosts. And yes, there's a similar kind of vibe there. I just think that the way that show nails the vacuousness of morning television. Alan's desperate, desperate need to be liked. And to succeed is very good.
Yeah, yeah. And I think also there's a strand in which British like daytime television, like morning television, is so funny anyway.
Yeah.
That it's so hard to satirize it effectively. Like the Like any clip of Richard Madeley, like there's a theory that Alan Partridge was heavily based on Richard Madeley. Although I feel as though Richard Madeley wasn't really famous enough at the time of the genesis of Alan Partridge. But there's like a clip where the great thing about Richard Madeley is kind of similar to Piers Morgan. He will like occasionally just be right about something, but in like an insane roundabout way. There's one where they were talking about Shamima Begum and like taking away her citizenship and not letting her back in the country. And he was like, just one thing that I always think about, you know, at the end of the war, the Nazis, obviously, many of them were tried and many of them were hanged. They were executed for their crimes against humanity that they committed during the war and the Holocaust. But we never went after the Hitler Youth, did we? Just something to think about, really. And I'm like, that's more Partridge than anything Steve Coogan can ever write. It's just perfect.
If you like that, yeah, you get a lot of that in this time. And you got all the studio stuff, then they also occasionally throw to a package where Alan's just been given free rein to go out and do whatever the hell he wants on any story. And it's
love a package.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. When's this time? When's that come out?
There's two seasons of it. And I think the last one was last year, maybe.
Yeah, all right.
A year or two ago. It's pretty,
right. Recent.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty up to date stuff.
He's still going.
Yeah, yeah. He's still going. He's still knocking it out. Yeah, no, Steve Coogan, I think, is, you know, comedians deal with the aging process differently. I think Steve Coogan has managed to kind of stay relevant.
Yeah.
He's not gone insane. Yeah. You got to pick something to go insane about when you hit 40. And Steve Coogan managed to pick something that wasn't relevant to his career.
What was that?
I don't know. There's a number of things you could pick up on. There's like young girlfriends, cars.
Okay.
He's got a few, but he hasn't gone insane in a way that's like affected his comedic output.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not gone down.
He's not gone to tarnish.
You know what group I hate?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's certainly not got on board the anti-woke PC gone mad kind of vibe.
Mm.
He's always been a PC guy. Able to do all that through Alan Partridge. Like, Alan can complain about that, promote about that, say politically incorrect stuff, and Coogan could be like, fuck you, John Cleese, it's fine.
Well, I remember years ago watching Steve Coogan on Question Time, our like late night political, whatever the fucking absolute chaos that it is. And he was on there and they were talking about, this must have been more than 10 years ago, the Labour Party at the time were talking about a mansion tax on houses worth over, what, £2 million or I don't know, whatever, some kind of, I don't know whether it's a good idea or not, whatever. And they were asking Steve Coogan about it, and they're like, well, you know, you say you support the Labour Party, but you live in a house that's worth more than £2 million. What would you do if there was a mansion tax? And you go, I just went, I'd pay it. I think they were just so not expecting that answer.
Yeah, they think the checkmate for anyone on the left is like, well, that would involve more taxes. And sometimes people go, yeah, I'll pay more taxes. Yeah, is he from Manchester? He grew up in Manchester, right?
I think so. Yeah, he's certainly from the Northwest. Yeah. Manchester area. Mm. Yeah. He's a Britpop guy. He's old Cougs. Anyway, that was Alan Partridge. It reminds me to thank Tom Ballard very much for joining us. What a rare delight.
Pleasure to be here.
We loved it. We love to have you
Most
here.
Most podcasts, like these, are about TV shows that people hate, you know, but you guys are just listening, watching fantastic comedy
yeah.
and being like, what a great show.
Sometimes it does make it a harder pod because you're just going like, yep, another great.
He's done it again.
He's done it again.
Well-structured, good jokes.
Why have you never watched any Alan Partridge?
Just missed it.
Yeah, right.
I don't know where it would have been that I would have been able to see it. And then
I used to play Knowing Me, Knowing You on the ABC. I was talking about this the other day. And I'm more familiar with that, really.
Because even when I went through the...
Yeah, because it's so much more niche in the grand scheme of the Partridge oeuvre.
Right.
Yeah.
The period of time when I went through the pirating TV shows.
Yes.
And a friend of mine who was big into British comedy, and we would swap back and forth, like, oh, this and this, so like Brass Eye and Space and The Office and stuff. For some reason...
Like Roy Chobby Brown, Jim Davidson.
Missed me and missed him as well. So which for whatever reason, Alan Partridge was never in that mix.
But I feel like Knowing Me, Know You is the Australian equivalent is the McAuliffe program.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
No.
Do you know Sean McAuliffe?
No.
Oh my God.
My Australian knowledge once again found lacking.
Yeah, McAuliffe program.
I think McAuliffe is probably our Steve Coogan equivalent.
Yeah, right? I think so.
Yes.
Mm. McAuliffe program I think is great. I remember seeing that at school. Unbelievable.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's very rare that you hear Australians talking positively about Australian television. So I do find that
well,
to be significant.
Well, yes. Sean is like, yes, he's widely beloved and his respect is like one of the most interesting and original. Matt Lucas is a massive Sean McAuliffe fan.
Oh, okay.
He is just returning
to
the
ABC. Well,
you
can't win them all.
he left. He had a show for a very long time called Mad as Hell, which was kind of like his version of a kind of Daily Show or Last Week Tonight vibe. Right, that was very funny with lots of character comedy. And they went for a long time, and then they retired. He said, "I'm stepping down from this show to make way for new, fresh talent at the ABC."
Mm-hmm.
And he did that, and no such a talent emerged, apparently. And now this year he's returning with a new show. He's coming back. And he's
no such talent emerged.
Apparently, yes.
That is very funny. We
they
asked
looked around and they were like,
said, nah.
Where is Sean?
Yeah. I remember once having a chat to an Australian comic, and I was like, well, you know, you're on TV a bunch. And he went, yeah, but Australian TV.
Oh!
I was like, brutal scenes. Yeah, I feel like if you grew up watching it, it has to be significant to you on some level to be on it, even in the... Because I think it's kind of the same here, where like
TV
is less and less relevant, but still there's a certain... You feel like some kind of level of success has been bestowed on you if you're on a TV show that you have previously watched, especially if you watched it as a child or like even though no one watches it now.
Sure.
There's 10 people in a home somewhere watching this who are too demented to remember who you are, and they will not be coming to a show. They're not mobile.
Still counts.
Yeah. It's more of an emotional thing than anything else. Anyway, that got bleak. Tom, is there anything you'd like to plug to the loyal listeners?
Oh, loyal listeners, prove your loyalty by coming to see me, Tom Ballard, live, please.
Yeah, he will test you.
Yes. Yes, my show, Good Point Well Made, is at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival for the entire month. I'm not taking a single day off.
Not a single day off?
Not a single day off.
Why?
Comedy and making people laugh so much. Yeah. Do you take a day off, Pete? No,
no,
with 6 million shows?
No, I would never.
We'll never
but
dream.
They just give you one. It's crazy to turn down the day off. Is by the time the day off rolls around, I'm like, thank Christ.
They said, Tom, do you want a day off? I said, no, people need to laugh. I can't
I
do
believe in the people. The people of Scotland are depressed enough.
It's at 4:20 at Monkey Barrel 2 every day of the Fringe. I'd love people to come to that. And then
Right before me.
Yes.
You're right after me.
What?
Yeah, I'm at 3:20, right next door at the City Cafe.
Holy shit.
Ooh, wow. Man, there's a deeply concentrated 5:45.
Holy heck.
Yeah. But I'm in literally the same room.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Gonna handball it over. Then if Steve Coogan's doing something, go see him.
You know? Yeah. Check him out.
But then I'm doing a tour in September, October, all over the UK too, from Manchester and Brighton and Leeds and Liverpool and lots of cool places like that. And all the details are at, well, just look at my socials, at Tom C. Ballard. And first ever UK tour. Would love some fans to come along and check it out.
Amazing. Yeah, and you should. I've not seen the current show, but I saw the previous show and it was very good.
Thank you, Milo.
I have every faith that the current show is as good, if not better.
I'd like to think I haven't gotten worse in the past year.
No. I mean, it could happen. Specifically, I don't think it's likely, but, you know, not unheard of. Yeah. And as ever, Pete and Luca have a podcast. It's called Ooh Spooky.
Yeah, 3 O's and an H. Three also, Adam Knox is on that podcast as well.
Adam Knox?
We don't need to include him.
Yeah, the inventor of the fort. Yeah. Well, clearly we're missing completeness on this podcast. There's a member of the Ooh Spooky podcast we've not had on, so we must.
Yes, got to rectify.
We must sort it out. Yeah, and if you're listening to this, this is a Patreon episode, I think. They alternate. Thank you very much for being a Patreon subscriber. You are the best. Please continue being a Patreon subscriber. I cannot impress on you enough the extent to which Phoebe needs little tiny socks for her infant son.
Right. And herself.
Yeah, and herself also. She is also quite small. Not as small as her infant son, but certainly on the smaller side. Of average adult, so not gonna speculate on her socks or anything. That feels like it's going in a weird direction.
You're gone partridge again.
This is not a feet guy podcast. Certainly not. If you're gonna imagine anyone's feet, imagine mine. I'm more comfortable with that. Let's leave her and her feet out of it entirely. Yeah, thank you very much for this.
Milo's funny stories.
News.
Bye-bye.